Puzzling over what to do this weekend? Well, you could go see the new thriller from the director of The Sixth Sense. It's called The Happening, and our critic, Bob Mondello, promises no spoilers.
People out strolling in Central Park on a beautiful summer's day. Then the strollers stop strolling and stand motionless.
Did you hear that?
And the dying starts.
It's weird. Those people look like they're clawing at themselves.
Spikes thrusting into jugular veins.
Is that blood?
Cops putting revolvers to their own foreheads. A weird aerial ballet of construction workers hurling themselves off 30-story buildings. Suicide after suicide until there's no one left to die. As apocalypses go, the one that opens The Happening is pretty arresting. But then it needs to be, coming from writer-director M. Night Shyamalan, who has made the artful explaining of the inexplicable a profitable little cottage industry for Tinseltown. Whether audiences will find the director's explanations compelling this time is another question, but of course I can't really talk about them. Suffice it to say that the worst thing anyone could possibly do is head out to the countryside, so naturally that's where our little family group goes. Earnest science teacher Mark Wahlberg, his emotionally constipated wife Zoe Deschanel, math teacher John Leguizamo, and his plucky little 6-year-old daughter. Unfortunately, the train they take goes to the middle of nowhere.
Train service has been discontinued. This will be the last stop for all passengers.
What do you mean? Where are we?
Filbert, Pennsylvania.
Filbert? Does anybody know where that is? Why are you giving me one useless piece of information at a time? What's going on? Hey, why would you just stop? You can't just leave us here.
As natural as Mark Wahlberg can be on screen, he probably shouldn't be required to ask urgent questions for 90 consecutive minutes, nor is it a good idea to have Zoe Deschanel express distress almost exclusively by popping her eyes while pursing her lips, nor to have John Leguizamo play a teacher who meets certain death with math riddles. Director Shyamalan, whose career has been offering ever-diminishing returns lately, has been telling interviewers that he does not want to be known as the guy who makes the scary movie with the twist, a plaint that would seem more heartfelt if he'd write or direct something other than a scary movie with a twist, but he's done the next best thing in The Happening by making it neither terribly scary nor all that twisty. The bigger danger after this and The Village and The Lady in the Water is that he'll become known as the guy who makes the inane movie with the idiotic premise. Fortunately, he still has an eye for visuals. Give him a reflective surface, and he'll layer information all over it. And to the extent that wind rustling through tall grass can be made threatening, he makes it threatening. But if what audiences are looking for is a thrill ride or even pervasive eeriness, The Happening's just not happening. I'm Bob Mondello.
Bob and his fellow critics may be giving The Happening the cold shoulder, but the movie is part of a hot trend, the environmental fright flick. NPR's Netta Ulaby takes a look at the latest in eco-horror.
All those deaths in New York and Philadelphia forced The Happening's heroes to join a mass evacuation.
You okay?
I see Boston got hit, too.
Where'd you hear that?
A friend from work. What about Yvette?
Oh, God, she made it out on the bus.
What the hell is going on, Elliot?
What's happening is an environmental catastrophe. Director M. Night Shyamalan originally called the movie The Green Effect.
Because when I was writing it and I sold it, I hadn't seen Inconvenient Truth yet. And when I saw that, I was like, oh man, this is worse than I thought.
Shyamalan joked that Al Gore's documentary may be the seminal horror film of the century. And in Inconvenient Truth's box office success may be partially responsible for the recent flood of apocalyptic dramas about climate change. Within the past few years, we've had Sunshine, The Day After Tomorrow, and even a CBS miniseries about global warming that had hurricanes sweeping through Chicago and tornadoes tearing through Vegas. Expect remakes soon of movies like The Swarm and Creature from the Black Lagoon that blame pollution and climate change for monstrous mutants. Next year, the science fiction epic Avatar, directed by James Cameron, will depict aliens and humans struggling for ecological survival. Film scholar Kendall Phillips says these movies all have one idea in common.
Somehow the planet has grown tired of us, and we've overstayed our welcome, and something bad is about to happen.
Environmental horror pictures are nothing new. Think Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster from 1971. Philip says eco-horror was common in the 70s when moviegoers escaped worries about a gas crisis with disaster films like Earthquake and movies about mutant frogs, alligators, and bears. Horror always seems to reflect the anxieties of its time, says scholar Kendall Phillips. But unlike the creature features of the past, today's eco-horror movies, like The Happening, see the whole world as malevolent and vengeful.
I'm scared, Elliot.
It's not that far a stretch from the old haunted house movies in which the house becomes kind of a character. So if you think of the Amityville Horror, now we're just expanding that so that literally the ecosphere plays that kind of menacing role.
Wow, our planet is the haunted house.
The sad truth is that the world is going to become a more and more desperate place. It's going to look more and more like a zombie film as we go along.
Independent filmmaker Larry Fessenden.
That's why I make horror films. I'm trying to say, wake up, people.
Fessenden has been making environmentally themed horror films for years. Animal testing or oil drilling are, to him, ideal subjects for the genre.
I can think of nothing more horrifying than the self-betrayal of destroying the very thing that you love, the very thing that nurtures you. And rather than make films about people killing their mothers, I make films about our sort of indescribable self-contempt that we would destroy the earth that gives us life.
Why wouldn't the wilderness fight us like any organism would fend off a virus?
The Last Winter is a Fessenden film that takes place in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. It's set in the near future, and the government has just granted oil company workers permission to drill.
Ever since I got here, I could tell that there was something wrong. Not the job, not the cold, not being isolated. I'm telling you, I've seen something out there in the snow.
Oil is literally the crushed plant and animal life from millennia ago, and now we're burning that. We're burning these corpses, and naturally that suggests sort of a ghostly return, and we're desecrating graves.
Larry Fessenden is now in talks with Leonardo DiCaprio's production company. DiCaprio last year produced a scary environmental documentary of his own, The 11th Hour. Hollywood has a long way to go when it comes to its own environmentalism, says Fessenden. Film sets leave massive carbon footprints. But he hopes that eco-horror can affect the cultural conversation.
We don't want to be in a horror film. We don't want to wake up in a horrible superstorm. We don't want to have wars over the last drops of water. We don't want our shores inundated with environmental refugees. These are all potentially on our horizon. We don't want to live in a horror film. We want to go to them at the movies and then come out and have a sweet and beautiful life.
After all, Fessenden says, what is a horror film but a cautionary tale? Neto Ulibi, NPR News.
Roman Polanski is one of the world's most famous directors. He made Chinatown, Rosemary's Baby, The Pianist, and other great films.
His achievements, though, are overshadowed by something he did more than 30 years ago, back in the 1970s.
Standing with his lawyer, Douglas Dalton, Polanski was asked by Deputy District Attorney Roger Gunson to what count he pleaded guilty. Polanski, I had intercourse with a female person, not my wife, who was under 18 years of age. Gunson, how old did you think the girl was? Polanski, I understood she was 13.
Right before he was to be sentenced, Polanski fled to Paris, never to return to the United States for fear of being arrested. That story, what happened during the trial and the fallout, is told in a new documentary that airs on HBO tonight.
I don't think anyone other than the two of them know what really happened, but I was more interested in what happened after that and what made him flee.
Marina Zenovich is the director of the documentary Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired.
You know, for me, with Roman Polanski, you always have to go back in time. You know, it starts with his childhood in Poland where he survived the Holocaust, where his mother was murdered, goes to London in the swinging 60s and is making films, Knife in the Water, Cul-de-Sac, meets Sharon Tate, they fall in love. And what was surprising for me was to just see how he had such hope in his life at a certain point when he was a hot young director after making Rosemary's Baby. and then she was murdered. So for me, in going back, it just painted a picture for me of what brought him to this night in 1977.
So do you think that the murder of Sharon Tate, and he did say his marriage to her was the happiest time of his life, do you think that after that he fundamentally changed?
I think Roman Polanski is a survivor, but I thought Mia Farrow said it best, kind of that, you know, he didn't have the blueprint for life that most of us do.
One hoped for Roman, you know, that this brand new life with a woman who loved him and who seemed so right for him, with a baby, that there would be this security that he had not had in his life. And in a new homeland, I mean, the future was his, we thought. And then everything just collapsed.
Now, this was, as you paint in your documentary, an incredible media circus, almost on the level of the O.J. trial. And at the center of it is the judge.
Judge Lawrence J. Rittenband, a fascinating character. I could have made a film about him. Rittenband was an elderly jurist who was quite powerful and cherry-picked this case, very media savvy and interested in what people thought of him.
But he's blamed by not only Polanski and Polanski's defense attorney, but also the prosecutor for a miscarriage of justice.
Yeah, I mean, when I was interviewing the lawyers and discovered what had happened kind of behind closed doors, I was astounded.
So what happened? What did he do that was the issue?
Polanski pleads guilty to unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor. The punishment was supposed to be based on a probation report. The judge got the probation report, and it said that he wasn't a mentally disordered sex offender, that he shouldn't go to jail. And I think he was feeling a lot of pressure and didn't know what to do, so started enlisting advice from Richard Brenneman, who was a young journalist for the Santa Monica Evening Outlook at the time. He said, you know, I went into his chambers and he looked at me and said, Dick, tell me, what do I do about Polanski?
I went, whoa, Your Honor, that's your decision. That's not mine. I'm a reporter. I can't advise you on something like that. I hadn't been covering courts that long, but I knew a decision by a judge was supposed to be a decision by a judge and was not to take in any advice from any other person other than what was there in the law books, what had been entered into evidence in the case.
I mean, it's all this kind of manipulation of how these cases work.
So Polanski gets wind of this and he...
Well, Polanski goes for the 90-day diagnostic. He's told by his lawyer, you know, keep your chin up. This is it. At the end of this, you are going to be free, because basically that's what the judge told the lawyers. And the judge calls the lawyers into chambers and says, I've changed my mind. You know, I want him to go back to jail, or I want him to be deported. I mean, he was just kind of spouting whatever. I don't think he knew what to do. And in the end, Polanski ended up not knowing what was ahead of him. And, you know, I don't want to give the movie away, but, you know, he flees.
What do the principals say now? What does the prosecutor say now about it?
I was quite shocked when the prosecutor in the case said to me in the interview, I'm not surprised that he left under those circumstances. It's a very telling moment in the film, just because he's come full circle to being on the same side as Polanski's attorney because of the judge's actions. It's in no way forgiving Polanski, but it's explaining why he fled.
You also interview the victim in this, Samantha Geimer, who for many, many years, she was unknown to most people. Her name wasn't out there. What did she have to say about all this?
I'm quite impressed with Samantha Geimer because she is over this. I think she's made peace with it. I think she wants to move on. I think, ironically, her lawyer wanted a plea bargain because he didn't want her to forever be known as the girl who had sex with Roman Polanski. But ironically, she is. And she's a happily married mother of three, very sunny and clear-eyed and just wants it to be finished.
Did you ever get an interview with Roman Polanski?
I ended up approaching Polanski at the end of production, and it took a very long time to get a response. I told him that I wanted to interview him, and he was very apologetic and said he didn't want to be a prima donna, but he just felt that he shouldn't be in the film.
Has he ever expressed remorse for this?
He has, but I don't think it's as much as our culture needs. Honestly, I mean, it's never just enough. So I think he feels that he went through the process and pled guilty and went through the probation report and went to what was to be considered his jail time. And he feels the rug was pulled out from under him. He suffered as well. It's mm-hmm. like, I think this case is a tragedy for everyone involved.
How did you come away feeling about him? What did you think of him?
My own opinion of Polanski changes because you feel different things for him at different times in his life. You know, you feel sorry for him as a kid and what he endured. You feel sorry for him with regard to the Sharon Tate murder. But then he committed horrific crime on a 13-year-old girl. But it was 30 years ago. And I'm not saying that we need to forgive him. I'm not saying that at all. It's just kind of like I think we need to take a look at what got him to that place. And that's what I tried to do by making this movie. I think the story of the case deserves to be told.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Marina Zenovich. Her new movie is called Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. It airs tonight on HBO.
It took a year of arguing with bureaucrats and a lot of frustration, but finally it happened in 2006. In Tehran, an informal Iranian women's soccer team played against a women's team from Berlin. It was the first time both met and the first match ever for the Iranian women. The players on both teams had to wear headscarves during the game. And even though attending an event at the stadium is considered entering a den of vice, hundreds of Iranian women turned out to cheer the teams on under the ever-watchful eye of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard. Iranian filmmaker Ayat Najavi, along with Marlena Osman, a German left field, set up the match and tell the story in the documentary Football Undercover. And Ayat Najavi, co-director of Football Undercover, is with me now in Studio 3A. So good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Tell us how this came about in the first place. This was really just kind of an idea you had, right?
Yeah. Actually, 4 years ago, I have made a short film with the same subject. And this short film has been shown in Berlin Film Festival in February 2005. And Manila Asman also presented another short film, also with the same subject, but in Berlin.
And what got you so interested in this idea of Iranian women's soccer? Why were you so interested in it?
In the first hand, when I heard about the female soccer in Iran, it was interesting because it is something which exists in Iran, but we never heard about it. So I got it interesting because I said, okay, there is something in it that the government want to hide it, want to, you know, make it as secret as possible. And it took me like 6 months to find footballers, soccer players. And when I talk to them, I start to understand that soccer for them has another meaning. Of course, it's a passion, it's enthusiasm, like everywhere in the world. But for them, as a girls in this strict Islamic society with all these limitations, it makes a role for them to fight against this limitation, or at least to show that they think different, they want to present differently. You know, they don't want to be in the form that the system want them to be.
Right, right. And how did you come up with the idea of getting this Berlin soccer team to go to Iran and play in this match against the Iranian women?
Yeah, everything started when Marlena and I met each other in Berlin Film Festival.
Marlena is the woman who helped you. She's a member of the soccer team.
And she's also a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So she has presented a short film about her team, which was recently established in Berlin. And it's a multicultural team with the Turkish people, with Arab people, with Eastern European people, like people from Greece. And it has a very, very great multicultural background. So Malin and I talk a lot about these two short films, and both of us choose the same subject, female soccer and the city, you know. But in these two short films, we had two very different words of football, words of women, words of film, actually. So the aesthetics of the films were also absolutely different. And we said, okay, these two short films can meet each other in a longer film and try to establish a dialogue between these two different worlds. You know, both worlds of football, worlds of film, you know. That's all how everything is starting.
And I think Marlena is standing by now. Is that correct? Have we got Marlena on the phone? Yes. Marlena, are you there? Hi. She's joining us on the line from Berlin. So good to have you with us, Marlena. I just I wanted to ask you, first of all, I really, in watching the film, I thought of you more as a soccer player, I have to say, than a filmmaker, because you were so involved with the team. And I wanted to ask you what it was like to play this game, because apart from anything else, all of the women were wearing headscarves. This was really had to be difficult, particularly for the women on the Berlin team, to come into Iran and have to play under those circumstances.
Yes, we had a bit of time to get used to the headscarf, because we had to wear it not only in the stadium but all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And also for the Iranians, it was not so usual to play with the headscarf, because they normally play inside futsal, and they are dressed just the same way we are dressed, with short pants and without a scarf. But now in this match, we wanted to film to make it public, and that's why they and we both had to wear the headscarf.
Yeah,
and of course it was a big topic. Like, we weren't able to practice like this before, because we didn't even know what it was going to be like.
Yeah, it seemed like there was an incredible energy in that stadium. An incredible amount of excitement. It was all women. In fact, Ayat was not able to get into the stadium. We'll get to that in a moment. But there just seemed to be so much excitement around this game. Did you sense that excitement coming at you from the fans?
Yes, it was really incredible. When we were leaving the dressing room and came outside just to warm up first, everybody was screaming, and we could just hear them. And it was so nice, because we were always hoping for the match to take place and also for people to come. And we were so curious to see what's going to be among the people who are coming. And then they were so noisy and so many, and like they painted their faces and they had big flags, and it was really nice to see them, and it was a big atmosphere.
I was wondering how they all found out about it, because you mentioned in the film that once you got there, you actually weren't allowed to put up your posters and advertise it very much.
Yes, we were also wondering. We didn't know. It was like somebody knew, and he told his friends, or she told her friends, and so on.
Did you have any idea it was going to have that kind of effect for women outside of the soccer team, for other women in Iran?
We were hoping for it. Football has a very big meaning in Iran, and also for women. And whenever many people come together, they are harder to control. And also, like, normally women may not go in the stadium when men are playing, so in our case it was just the other way around.
Yeah.
And it was not only the first opportunity for the players to play, but also for the fans to cheer in the stadium. And so we thought that it was going to be really interesting what's happening. And also we had more cameras in the audience than on the football team.
Right.
Because we really wanted to see what's going to be there. But it was just so great to really see it happening.
And Ayat, after having this great idea of doing this, you weren't able to get into the stadium to see the game. The film shows you standing outside trying to peek in and see what's going on, because you're a man. You couldn't go into the stadium with all these women.
Yeah, we did know from the beginning that it would be no chance for men to go, but we always thought that, okay, it would be, you know, expectation, but didn't work out, so we had to stay outside. But in that moment, for me, it has two aspects, actually. First, as a filmmaker, together with David, we couldn't go inside, and it was really hard to control what's going on, you know, the photographers and all the stuff. But also as an Iranian, it was a great chance to experience in a great social level that something always happened for women in Iran. They always ignored, you know, it's always hard for them to be part. And it was for the first time that they had the control of everything, and we as men were ignored. So I could, you know, I could imagine such a hard life they have, mm-hmm. usually. And it was always in theory, but it was for, you know, actually I experienced it.
Great. We're going to take a call now. We're going to go to Betty. She's calling from Chicago. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I'm a 62-year-old recreational runner, but I'm a walker, but I'm very committed to it. And I'm wondering if, as what happened to me, having started running or walking after the age of 35, if the Iranian women had a feeling of social independence or freedom, that they could do more because they were able to participate in a sport that stereotypically is reserved for men.
Actually, there is a sport for women in Iran, but as we present in football on the cover, it's always separate. For example, we have a national running team. We have like taekwondo or karate or, you know, other sports. Uh-huh. So it's possible for women to go running,
yeah,
even in the public, but they have to put on like, you know, a scarf and long dresses.
Right.
Like, yeah, so the problem is only the presentation of women, you know. Mm-hmm. They have no liberty to choose their presentation.
So in other words, they can participate in sport, but they weren't able to participate in a game that other people would be watching then.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Do you feel, though, as though now they kind of are maybe chomping at the bit to be public representatives of Iran to show that women can do this too?
Actually, I think Football on the Cover can show something which might be new for people here. So I recommend you to watch the movie because, you know, we show in Football on the Cover that the situation of women in Iran is really terrible. It's really, the limitations are so hard. But we also show that the women in Iran are so strong and they keep fighting against this situation. So they didn't accept it. They never accepted, actually, from the beginning of revolution. They never accept, but they had to, you know, present themselves like what the system like, because, you know, the system was a bit wild and a bit tough against them. But they keep going, and every single day they have something new, some good development, some good progress.
I have to ask you about one of the Iranian women who you were following in this film and was instrumental in getting this game going, and then in the end wasn't allowed to play in the game. And it wasn't clear to me why. What exactly happened there?
You know, that's the question.
They just didn't let her do it?
Yeah, it's Iran. It's Iran. We always say in Iran, it's Iran. There is no clear reason for her, for she, for us, for no one. And we just keep it as a, you know, we present this story in film to be a metaphor for a situation of women in Iran. When you are independent, when you had an outspoken character, when you want to show strongly that you are different, you would be ignored.
Yeah.
And it's what happened
and
for
Nilufar. And she was a very different kind of woman for Iran because she kind of, like, she dressed as if she was a man.
Yeah, actually, in this aspect, yeah, she is a bit different. But in other respects, I would say she represents the middle class of Tehrani people.
And let me just ask you, Marlena, is this something you would want to do again? Would you want to go back to Tehran and play with the Iranian women again?
Of course. And I'm also planning to go back to Iran.
Oh, you are?
Yes, having the same match over again will not be possible.
Wow. Was this really a life-changing experience for you and the other women on the Berlin team?
Yes, it definitely was. And also, we were working on it for 3 years, so it was a very big part of my life.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Marlena.
Thank you.
Marlene Osman is co-producer of Football Undercover. She was one of the players from the German team, and she joined us on the line from Berlin. Also joining us today in the studio was Aya Najavi, co-director of Football Undercover. It was so good to talk with you, and good luck with your film.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation.